this time on your weekly constitutional.
Sometimes it gets reduced to it's just locker room talk. We've heard that, particularly in 2016, after the Access Hollywood audio tapes came out.
That was Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, a law professor at the University of California at Irvine, who recently wrote an article in the Huffington Post about her experience trying to report sexual harassment. We'll also hear from Brooklyn College professor Casey Johnson, who's concerned about due process in the current Me Too movement.
It seems to me that academics, more so really than any other profession in the country, have an obligation to stand up for due process.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about Me Too and the process that's due.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Do you remember the first time you saw the hashtag MeToo on Facebook or perhaps on Twitter? I do, and I remember thinking, that's rather interesting. I wonder what will happen with it. Well, like most of you, I had no idea of the effect of this hashtag and this movement and the slew of powerful men who have been forced from office or lost their jobs or have made tearful apologies. It has been an extraordinary moment in American history. But even as we celebrate the fact that women are feeling more comfortable coming forward, free to come forward with these terrible stories, on the other hand, there's an issue of due process, isn't there? Sometimes the accusations seem to be enough to cause all kinds of problems for the accused before there's any kind of adjudication of their guilt or innocence. This has caused a number of people to express concern. One of those people is Casey Johnson, a professor from Brooklyn College. We'll hear from him later. But let's start with Michelle Goodwin of the University of California at Irvine, who recently wrote an article in the Huffington Post about the difficulties she had trying to report an incident of sexual harassment.
My name's Michelle Goodwin, and I'm a chancellor's professor at the University of California, Irvine, where I hold faculty positions in the School of Law, but also gender and sexuality studies, criminology, law and society, and a couple other departments.
And we're talking via Skype today, and I must say I'm astonished at the quality because you're in a rather exotic location at the moment, aren't you?
That's right. We are doing this call from Bali. I'm in Bali, and you're on the East Coast.
Yes.
So thank you for having me on your show. It's a really important topic we're going to cover.
It is an important topic. And, of course, my calling you was prompted by a recent article that you wrote in the HuffPost. So could you tell us about that, please?
Well, the piece comes out in part of both professional and also personal experience. And that is, it's a piece about complicit bias in sexual harassment and this moment that we're in talking about these issues. And it struck me that one of the matters that we're not bringing to the table is about how these types of issues fester and the cultures around them, because they've been treated in the media as one-off, such as a person did something terrible, someone suffered the ill consequences of that, and now we know about it. And very little attention has been placed on, well, what are the institutions that allow these things to occur? They don't happen in isolation. Sometimes they might, such as a rape in a hotel room, but very often people know about these things. There have been whispers or there have been direct reports, and yet the behavior continues and the people continue to hold their jobs. And so I reflected on an experience that I had as a young law professor where I observed someone sexually harass a student and reported it, and it didn't get handled or addressed in a timely manner. And in fact, it created a kind of institutional paralysis. And while that paralysis occurred, the harasser went on a full-scale assault against me for having reported it in very public ways. And this is what I speak to in the piece about complicit bias and the culture around these issues, because everybody knew about it. In that case, it was a colleague who grabbed a student and put his mouth on her and licked her at a public event. Many people...
Okay, that requires a little bit more explanation. What exactly was going on with this guy?
Well, it was a fundraiser, and it was a fundraiser for students to support public interest work. And there was a pie-throwing contest. The students bid on various things, lunches and dinners with professors. And there was a student who bid on a pie throwing contest. And actually, it was a guy who bid on it, but there was a woman who wanted to toss this pie. And so her friend deferred and allowed her to toss this pie at the associate dean. And when she did, there was a residue of cream that was left on her hand and arm, which is to be expected when you throw a cream pie. Well, as she walked past one of my colleagues, he twisted her arm behind her and licked her entire arm. And the student turned around mortified by it. I was absolutely stunned by it and thought that was just absolutely awful. You just simply don't do that. Everybody should know that. I mean, that's the kind of thing that three-year-olds at preschool know they're not supposed to do. They're not supposed to lick people. So anyway,
that is so extreme. I'm sitting here with my mouth agape, and in fact, it reminds me that we had a fundraiser at my law school some years ago, and they bid on the privilege of throwing a pie in my face, and they did so. I can even remember the woman who did it with great glee, and we are still friends to this day. And perhaps one of the reasons we're still friends to this day is that I did not presume to lick her arm. I mean, that is such an extreme, ridiculous, inappropriate thing to do that I forgive me. I have to get that image out of my mind. Okay, so you witnessed this. You witnessed this woman's mortification. What happened then?
Let's take a pause on that and say that what does that mean in terms of culture, right? Where that mm-hmm. is so horrific, but someone thinks it's okay to do. That says a lot about culture, and certainly at that particular space and time in law nearly 20 years ago. So anyway, that was a Friday evening, and I reported it by Monday morning. And my sense was that the dean would deal with it. And, you know, that she would call him into the office. He might, you know, say, I didn't do it, but that would be fine. I was willing to stand up and say, yes, I did see it, but that it would be addressed and that there would be protocols in place, warning, suspensions, whatever, the equivalent of suspensions for law professors, though tenure gets in that way. But what I didn't expect is that the ball would be dropped and that there would be nothing for a while, and then that it would be passed on to a subordinate of the dean, which is what she did. She passed it on to a junior male colleague who was an associate dean. And that associate dean later admitted that he didn't do anything because he played cards with this person every Friday and felt awkward raising it. And so it wasn't until weeks later on a Sunday when I was very much blindsided by an email that was sent to the entire faculty that called me a liar. And that was the mildest of the expletives and whatnot, the barrage that would then come at me for weeks after that, sometimes daily, multiple emails saying that I was blind, I was a liar, I didn't know what I saw, that these things didn't happen. And there were things that could have happened right away, such as the dean shutting down his email account because you don't use faculty emails to harass a professor. And it's worth noting that at that time, I was the youngest person on the faculty. I was the junior most person. I had just started law teaching just 3 months before that. And I was the only Black person on the faculty. So it hit every category of just awfulness of the senior white male colleague doing this. And in the space of it, the dean would visit my office and cry and tell me she was so sorry that she wished that she had handled it. There were other people who would visit my office and say, he's awful. We've known for a very long time that he does these kinds of things. There was a senior colleague who was actually senior to this guy who filed an anonymous complaint but couldn't bring herself forward to be public in her complaint. So that was imputed to me as well. So what I began to see, though I was the junior most person on the faculty, I saw people that were senior to me who did not know how to handle these issues. The dean crying in my office every night. Colleagues saying they knew this.
That is extraordinary, that the dean, who has so much power, is responding to the situation by not responding to it and thinks this sort of tears in your office are going to somehow fix the situation.
Well, it was, you know, it was a deep paralysis. And for her part, you know, it was, there were things that were ironic. For example, she was the law school's first female dean, mm-hmm. one of the first female law deans in the country. I'm sure this was not the way in which she thought that she would be coming to the close of her career. She was actually let go, not only for this issue, but others by the end of that semester, whereas he remained on the faculty. So there are all sorts of ironies that played out in this ineffectiveness of her response to this issue, but that beyond her as an institution kind of collapsing on itself. And I think that, you know, in part, this is exactly why people fear coming forward when they have been directly harassed, right? I was not the student who was licked by this. I was not a colleague who was sexually harassed, but I was a colleague who was harassed for reporting it. And it all didn't come to an end until one of the more quiet people on the faculty, who was probably the most conservative person on the faculty, went to this person's office and said, "I know you did it and you need to stop." And amazingly, it did stop. But not before another email was sent out to the entire faculty. And in that email, this colleague said, well, he remembered what happened. And it was a day in which lots of people were having fun except for one person. And that was supposed to be me, I suppose. And that he recalls that there was a pie throwing contest. And as the student walked by, he wondered what type of cream it was, whether it was whipping cream or shaving cream. And so he gently took her hand, licking only the uppermost layer of cream from her pinky finger. Many people might think that sounds like soft pornography. It certainly sounds premeditated. And it didn't sound much better than my version that he was intoxicated and he grabbed her and he licked her. Neither version absolves someone of sexually harassing a student and putting his mouth on her, where she, even if it's a gentle lick, it doesn't absolve keeping your mouth off of your students.
I've never really considered the issue of degrees of licking, but I guess that was what he was trying to
do. I think that's what he was trying to do. But in the process, what that meant for me is it in the process of the daily harassment and the daily onslaught of the emails and, you know, impugning my character and whatnot, I thought about whether or not I should stay at that law school. I thought whether or not I should actually stay in law teaching. You know, one wonders to what extent is this somewhat normalized in law schools. I mean, clearly there aren't places where, you know, there are people that are just lickers on faculties, but it does mean that there can be cultures where the power dynamics are so intense and strong. And certainly at that time, most law schools were predominantly males in terms of the faculty. There were more women who were coming onto the faculty and were holding tenure track positions. But the history of these institutions have been very male dominated and so forth. And, you know, and I decided to stay. And I will tell you, one of the reasons why I decided to stay is that I have grandparents who came through Jim Crow and the civil rights movement. And I was really sort of fixating on the experiences of older Black women. And, you know, and the sort of thought came to me that it was not my job to leave. I was not the person who had committed a wrong. I was not a person who should have been shamed for coming forward. I was a person who stood up for my student and for the institution. And for that reason, I should not leave. And by actually standing up in that way, it created this very interesting dynamic where my colleague kind of became invisible. He kind of took himself out of the law school. I guess he was so stunned by the fact that someone stood up to him, even if it happened to be the junior woman on the faculty who happened to be a Black person.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we've been talking with law professor Michelle Goodwin of the University of California at Irvine about her experience trying to report sexual harassment and how that plays into the Me Too movement of today. Later on, we'll hear from Professor K.C. Johnson of Brooklyn College about his concerns about due process in that movement. Stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's return to our conversation with Professor Michelle Goodwin of the University of California at Irvine, who has been talking with us about her experience that she wrote about recently in the Huffington Post, trying to report a rather disturbing incident that she witnessed when she was a junior law professor. I'm very sorry you had to go through that, but I certainly admire your willingness to stick around and keep fighting. So that was your personal experience, and so you have experienced the shaming and the abuse that is heaped upon people who come forward, and you've experienced personally the damage that can do. So I guess, well, I won't guess anything. I'll ask you, what is your reaction to this current Me Too movement that's exploding across the internet?
Well, it's an overdue time, and I think it would be a mistake if we were to think about this as happening only behind the cameras. So when we think about the Kevin Spacey, Matt Lauer, Harvey Weinstein, and so many others, those are the type of Hollywood, or if not Hollywood, it's behind the camera moment of people who are Hollywood talent or otherwise celebrities who have come forward. And I think that that's really important, because for a very long time, everyone in society has known about the director's couch. And it's just taken that is just a means of how one is able to land a role in Hollywood. I'm sure that there are women who are much, much older who can also tell really challenging, horrific stories about Hollywood. But I think it also obscures what's happening, or what has happened, in broader aspects of society. And that's one of the things that my op-ed looks to do, is to say, well, there are other spaces in which these things occur. So it's important that we talk about them. And I think it's really important that we get to the point where we can talk about these issues in nuanced ways as well, in ways that engage the prospect of due process. I mean, for example, when I reported my colleague to the dean, I expected that the dean would engage in due process with it. I was willing to stand up for what I saw, but I did imagine that that process would actually take place. There's going to be a question about what that means now in these spaces too. And I don't think that people who care about women and care about, and these are not issues that just happen to women. So I don't think that people who care about sexual harassment should actually be concerned about a conversation about due process, such as they won't be believed. I think this is the moment that is happening, where women and others who are coming forward are being seen as credible people in relaying their stories.
Yeah, and I think that's extremely important, because for so many years, the victims were dismissed or were shamed into silence, or were simply reluctant to come forward. So I agree with you. It's a very, very important moment. But you've mentioned due process, and that's the flip side of this. So many of these things don't happen as the frosting licking incident did out in the public with witnesses. So many of these things happen in private spaces, and then it becomes a he said, she said narrative. And the issue of due process does become very important, because, of course, as we've seen, at least in some notable circumstances, such as the Duke Lacrosse situation or the University of Virginia Rolling Stone situation, sometimes these allegations are not credible. So I guess we really have to worry about balancing our concern for equality on the one hand with our concern for fairness to the accused on the other.
I think that is right, because that is what the law, that is the objective goal of the law, no matter what. And I think that that's very important. But I also think that in these instances, far more often than not, there are other people who know about these things and who don't come forward. And I think that's part of the lesson from my story, which is that, yes, it's rare, perhaps, that it's going to be a broad open event or something where later someone is harassing someone on an email listserv. But those actually aren't so unusual. I mean, we actually see that on Twitter and in other spaces, just very broad, out public harassment. Sadly, we see that kind of tone coming even from high offices in the United States. So I think that there are people who do witness, and I think that there are witnesses who are loath to come forward because they just simply don't want to get entangled in these types of issues. And if we think about what is demanded by due process, I mean, we really do need witnesses. You think about any kind of courtroom scenario, you got to get witnesses who can help to fill out the story. And what's interesting is that even if there were people who didn't lay eyes on it, often there are people who tell their stories, whether it happens to be the person who is the victim of sexual assault, who tells someone, this happened to me, or even, interestingly enough, the perpetrators. What I learned far more than I ever imagined to and did not want to by colleagues who told me stories about what they had witnessed or observed or heard about with this other colleague. So what I think that we can pay more attention to is the fact that other people do know.
Yeah, and they need to come forward. I realize that it's very, very difficult, but that's extremely important. And some of the corroborating evidence in many of these cases we're reading about in the press has to do with contemporaneous statements made by the victims to their loved ones or to their close friends. And I think that that's also something that's relevant. If a woman is assaulted and then she goes home and she tells her mother or she tells her friends, and then later on those statements can come into evidence as well, that does tend to underscore that evidence of the accuser.
Yeah, this is true. And you know, something else that gets complicated in this space is that sometimes people are told, don't say anything. You know, don't say anything. You really want that movie part, and that part should be yours. So just be quiet and let it go. And there were people who told me that maybe I should never have said anything. And, you know, let the student come forward. If the student isn't bothered by it enough to file a complaint, you know, why should I? And so there are those kinds of statements. And one of the things that I'm finding interesting in the Me Too moment of Hollywood is the response when men come forward. There's a sense of, oh, great, a man has been able to come forward and say that he too saw what I experienced. And that's whether it's a judge, such as with Judge Kaczynski, and there's news going around about that, or with Harvey Weinstein. And that's also something that's very interesting for us to take a moment to look at in our culture. What it means when a man says, oh, yes, she did experience it, I saw it, versus when you can have a slew of women who come forward and say, well, I not only saw it, I experienced it. So we still have to work those issues out in our society as well.
Yep. As you know, there have been a long history in this country of dismissing women and their testimony, and of course, minorities as well, and their testimony
With Black women, let us just say that this goes back very deep. It goes centuries for Black women, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so today we can say that, oh, well, Thomas Jefferson, yes, with Sally Hemings, where for centuries Black women had been saying this. And it's not just former presidents, it's others. It's a system that we created in our country through antebellum slavery that said women's bodies can be property and they can become sexualized property, and that these women not only have no say about what happens with their body, they have no credibility afterwards. And so in a lot of ways, this Me Too moment, which was actually started by a Black woman with this hashtag and narrative years ago, which has now picked up steam, is to say, well, me too, I'm a woman too, what happens to our lives and our bodies matters too. And that's the part of the Me Too that is also not getting sufficient attention.
So maybe it's just a matter of giving women respect and giving them credibility that's equal to their male counterparts.
I think that you've nailed it on the head. And, you know, and if we can begin to even think about these issues before our professional lives, such as what's happening in the interactions of children and schools and whatnot, and we certainly see the challenges of these issues on college campuses as well. So, you know, it's a broader societal discussion that is an urgent need. And I would very much urge that we think about it beyond Hollywood, beyond the backside of cameras, and think about these issues in Congress as well, and in other spaces, law firms too, in medical schools. And you know, I work at a university, and quite frankly, we need to think about it more broadly in those spaces, particularly in STEM and tech spaces, again, spaces where there are fewer women and where women may feel far more vulnerable if they were to come forward. And in this case, it's not always their professors. It may be their male colleagues.
Yes, it may very well be. I've been reading lots of stories about the STEM field and the culture and some of these startups. It really, again, is just sort of astonishing to me. Both of my boys were STEM majors in college and hang around a lot of STEM people, and I've never witnessed that sort of behavior personally, but I don't doubt that it happens all the time. Indeed, like so many men out there, I've been hearing from my female friends and acquaintances and family members really sort of astonishing stories that I've never heard before from my own relatives. And I think there are lots of conversations like that going on all across the nation right now. And I think it's a very cathartic moment.
I think that that's right. I mean, I just very recently heard from some junior academics who were sharing experiences about their times at law firms, where there are certain senior partners at firms that were given handlers over the summer so that they wouldn't sexually harass the young women summer associates who come in, you know, for internships during the summers of law school, right? So these are pervasive issues. And what's interesting about them is that there are ways in which we can be conditioned not to hear what, in fact, has just been said, or to be conditioned not to see just what has been witnessed. And sometimes it gets reduced to, it's just locker room talk. We've heard that, particularly in 2016, after the Access Hollywood audio tapes came out depicting President Trump explaining how he engages with some women in Hollywood. And, you know, afterwards there was, well, that's just locker room talk. So again, it's a way of hearing something and then finding a translation for it and saying, well, okay, that really doesn't matter what we just heard, because we found a way to compartmentalize it. And so our challenge will be, well, how do we stop this compartmentalizing when we're actually right there in the moment? And how do we avoid dismissing what we've seen and what we've heard, while at the same time, and I do think that it's important, giving the opportunity for people who have been alleged to have done these things to be heard. And I think that that is urgently important, because the other side of it that also has historic roots is during Jim Crow, Scottsboro boy trials. I mean, lots of instances where African-American males were alleged to have done things that they simply didn't do, mm-hmm. and paid dire consequences for it, including lynching.
Right.
I think that the Emmett Till case says a lot, because as we now know, the woman who was at the center of this, on her deathbed, she confessed to a biographer that she lied.
Yeah, and if anyone ever hasn't...
It doesn't bring him back. And if anyone has any doubt about what happened to him, just look up the pictures online. It was absolutely horrific. Okay, we're getting short on time, Michelle. So one last question. Roy Moore, a turning point?
I certainly hope so. And what's interesting at the crux of that is, again, how Black women showed up in that election, and how at least the narratives that were heard about women who said when they were 14 and 15 and 16 years old and he sexually accosted them, clearly that resonated with certain segments of the Alabama population. And it shouldn't have taken that, because this was a man who twice before had been kicked off the bench, and it had a notorious history while on the bench of very misogynistic anti-woman types of court rulings. So maybe it's a turning moment. We will see. Let us hope so.
Michelle Goodwin of the University of California at Irvine, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and your perspective on this. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on your show. I very much appreciate it.
And that was Michelle Goodwin of the University of California at Irvine. Now let's hear from another academic who's concerned about due process in the Me Too movement.
I'm Casey Johnson. I'm a professor of history at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. I was trained as a congressional historian, and a lot of my early academic works were histories of Congress. And the recurring theme, really, I think, throughout all of my scholarship has been an emphasis on procedure, an interest in how procedure works, and also how distortions of procedure can lead to troubling results.
As a teacher of civil procedure, I must applaud your focus on that. It's often very dry, and often it's dismissed as mere technicalities or red tape, and yet I think it's procedure is where justice resides.
It's extraordinarily important. The field of congressional history I like to joke that I'm among the five leading congressional historians in the academy today, because there are only around five of us in the academy today. It's a very, very small field, and you can't study Congress without an emphasis on procedure, because so much of what Congress has done over the course of American history has been to channel tricky political matters into procedural disputes as a way for members of Congress to shade or evade how they're responding to to political pressure.
This dovetails so nicely with one part of your background that I find fascinating. I see you did some work on Lyndon Johnson. And I recall when I was reading Robert Caro's biography of Johnson that he emphasized how Johnson learned the procedures of the Senate over painstaking months of observation and study. And he was then able to turn that knowledge into a tool that enabled him to basically dominate that institution throughout much of the 1950s.
Precisely. And then, and used it as president in the 1960s. One mm-hmm. of the remarkable things about the Johnson tapes is his discussions with individual members of Congress. He's really the closest thing I think we've ever had to a prime minister in terms of this very, very detailed understanding of how Congress worked. Not sure that you could do that in the contemporary environment, but he did it very effectively.
He did indeed. Well, that brings us to the subject that we want to talk about today, and that's one extremely important aspect of procedure. In fact, perhaps the very heart of all procedure in our judicial system, the concept of due process. Due process is notoriously difficult to define, but I think perhaps the simplest and easiest explanation of it is simply fairness, treating people fairly when important interests are at stake. And many people have expressed concerns in the current environment, even people who are very much feminists and people who care about equality and treatment of women. They've expressed some concerns about the so-called Me Too movement and its emphasis on believing accusers, sometimes perhaps at the expense of innocent defendants. Do you have any thoughts on that matter?
Yeah, I do think that in some ways, we're experiencing an evolution of attitudes that had existed on campus and had developed on campus in the last several years and have now bled into the mainstream in this very sudden and abrupt fashion. I mean, my involvement in this general issue dates back around a decade ago to the Duke lacrosse case. We had these three lacrosse players who were charged by the district attorney. And what struck me about the case initially, what drew my attention to it, was not so much the criminal case itself, because at the start I knew very little about it. I didn't know, I had no connection to the Duke people. It was the response of the Duke faculty, these statements that seemed to imply.
Before you go on, Casey, they were charged with one of the most serious crimes one can be charged with, and that is forcible rape.
Forcible rape. Had they been convicted, the minimum sentence under North Carolina law would have been 30 years in state prison. This was an extraordinarily serious allegation. And the district attorney, this guy named Mike Nifong, who was up for election and was clearly using this, as the state bar later found, for political purposes, seemed to have as his goal violating as many different procedures in a single case as he possibly could. But the accuser was African American. The accused students were white. It was a kind of perfect storm ideologically on campus. And the Duke faculty seemed to be serving as cheerleaders for Nifong. And one of the things that got me involved in the case and continues to trouble me about the case now is that it seems to me that academics, more so really than any other profession in the country, have an obligation to stand up for due process. I mean, it's one of the goals of the academy and here we had an instance where their own students were being victimized by this prosecutor through unfair procedures, and the Duke faculty were basically indifferent to that, because their preferred outcome in the case was for the guys to be found guilty, because it would vindicate broader ideological judgments that they had about the state of American society, about the state of the Duke campus, about the state of town-gown relations in Durham. And it was a really good example of the way in which ideological preconceptions, and I think we're seeing some of this now in the Me Too movement, can blind advocates to basic fairness in terms of evaluating the truth. And the lacrosse case is a great example, and it's a good reminder to all of us that due process, it doesn't exist simply to protect the rights of the accused. It exists because hundreds of years of tradition have shown that it's the best way to determine the truth when you have contested questions on serious issues.
Oh, yes. Actually, in many crime situations, it's not just protecting the accused, it's protecting society, because if you convict the wrong person, then the right person is still out there committing crimes.
Absolutely.
So, yes, this is a much bigger issue than just fairness to the defendant, although that's certainly big enough out of itself.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week we're discussing the Me Too movement. Earlier we heard from Professor Michelle Goodwin of UC Irvine, who told about her experiences on this subject. Now we're hearing from Professor Casey Johnson of Brooklyn College, who's very concerned that even as we appropriately punish sexual harassment, that we don't lose sight of due process. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Casey Johnson, a professor at Brooklyn College, who's been involved with issues of due process and accusations of sexual impropriety, even sexual crimes, at least since the Duke lacrosse incident of several years ago, where a number of young men were wrongfully accused of a terrible crime.
Before we go on, could you give us a little bit of reminder of exactly what the accusations were and exactly what Mr. Nifong did?
So the three students were charged with rape, with sexual assault, with kidnapping. They were immediately suspended from Duke. The prosecutor, Mike Nifong, who also served essentially as the chief investigator, managed to gather evidence against them by ordering the Durham Police Department to bring in the accuser, a woman named Crystal Mangum, show her photographs of the 46 white lacrosse players on the team, tell her that these were the 46 white lacrosse players on the team, and essentially invite her to pick three. She picked four, and they ignored the fourth anyway, because her story was that the three attacked her. Nifong also withheld exculpatory DNA evidence.
Oh, my. That's a direct violation of the Brady case.
Precisely. Okay. And even worse, lied about it to the trial judge in the case. He was asked point blank by the trial judge in the summer of 2006 whether he had turned over all of the DNA evidence. And he said yes. And this is what ultimately led to the state ethics board filing charges against him. That led to his removal from the case. The case was then reinvestigated by the then Attorney General of North Carolina, Roy Cooper, who's now the Democratic governor of North Carolina. Cooper did the investigation that Nifong refused to do. He started from the start. And what Cooper concluded was that this allegation never happened. He was able to use electronic evidence, witness statements to show that, you know, what we had here was an accuser who was lying.
So the accuser, for whatever reason, decided that she was going to lie. And then this fellow, Mr. Nifong, decided for perhaps political reasons, because he was up for re-election and perhaps wanted support among women or the black community or the wider community, that he was going to railroad these three young men and put them in prison for decades just so he could be re-elected. That is just, to this day, I can hardly believe that a person would do such a thing. A lawyer, somebody who's supposedly sworn to uphold justice, would do that. But there it is. There it is. He did it. It's been established. And it reminds me so very strongly of something that happened just a couple of years later at the University of Virginia. I'm sure you're familiar with that circumstance.
The Rolling Stone case, you know, one of the things that I assumed, you know, I lived the Duke lacrosse case for 18 months. I did a blog on it. I co-wrote a book on it. You know, I was really sort of immersed in it. And the
What's the name of that book before we leave it?
The book is called Until Proven Innocent. I wrote it with Stuart Taylor, the D.C. Journalist and legal analyst.
Okay, so if people want to see it, Until Proven Innocent, they can find that on Amazon or at their local bookstore. Okay, please go on.
And so the one thing I thought that was the baseline lesson from the Duke case is that you couldn't make an argument that at the very least elite campuses were indifferent to the issue of sexual assault or were somehow inclined to disbelieve accusers in sexual assault. You know, this was a case, the Duke case, where the accuser was almost unbelievably non-credible. I mean, she never told the same story twice. There were different numbers of attackers. What they did to her was allegedly different. I mean, there was no consistency at all. And yet, 8 years later, we see this case at the University of Virginia, which Rolling Stone highlights in an article that they subsequently have to retract, in which this accuser, a woman named a student at UVA named Jackie, claims that she was gang raped in what amounted to a fraternity initiation ritual, where seven fraternity brothers raped her on a glass table, and that at some point in the attack, the glass shattered and it was driven into her back. I mean, we had these very, very serious injuries, but she never went to the hospital. And Rolling Stone accepted this as the truth as part of their agreement to interview Jackie they agreed that they would not seek to speak to the person that she accused, which turns out a good point on her part because this person didn't exist. She just sort of made him up. And when the article appeared, it was accepted as gospel at the University of Virginia. The president immediately suspended all fraternities. There were campus protests. But the most depressing aspect of the UVA story to me was that after the article had been discredited, largely due to the reporting of the Washington Post and questions that were asked by a libertarian journalist named Robbie Suave and a New York journalist named Richard Bradley, Rolling Stone retracts. They say, you know, we have no evidence for this. But at UVA, it was as if she had told the truth all along. The student government passed a resolution urging, they said, we have to take the lessons for this. And the lesson that this is the student leadership of UVA, was that UVA should go to the Virginia General Assembly and ask them to change rape law for the entire state of Virginia to allow all rape trials to occur in secret. And their argument was that this would be the way that accusers like Jackie, victims like Jackie, could tell their story, in truth. So at least in the Duke case at the end, people were willing to, on campus, were willing to acknowledge that an attack never happened. 8 years later, by 2014 into 2015, at UVA, they were unwilling even to acknowledge that.
This is so terribly troubling, and obviously it leads directly into a discussion of the so-called Title IX situation, where campuses have invented their own procedures for investigating allegations of sexual harassment of various types, and have done so, I'm sorry to say, under guidance provided by the Department of Education, which essentially stripped defendants of most due process. I've often said to people that I care very, very deeply about the issues surrounding sexual harassment. I have a mother, I have a wife, I have a sister, I have two nieces. I don't want any of them abused. But I also have two sons, and I don't want them railroaded. And the terrible, tragic circumstance is that much of this alleged abuse occurs in a he said, she said situation. And I don't know exactly what we're supposed to do about that, but it seems to me that denying due process to the accused is not the solution.
Right. So I completely agree. Yeah, so in 2011, the Obama administration's Education Department issues guidance, which they then supplement in 2014, that reinterprets Title IX, Title IX's famous sex discrimination law passed in 1972, to give to the federal government authority to dictate to colleges and universities what procedures they have to use. And every single procedural demand from this guidance made it more likely that an accused student would be found guilty. So colleges were ordered to lower the burden of proof to a preponderance of the evidence, 50.01%. They were ordered to allow accusers to appeal not guilty findings. They were ordered to have the Title IX coordinator, a person whose job in effect depends on getting guilty findings, train the adjudicators in the case. So this would be the equivalent in a criminal trial if in rape trials the prosecutor got to train the jury outside of the notice of the defense. All of this training is secret. It's not provided to the accused student. The Obama administration strongly discouraged cross-examination. There was a study by a Miami University law professor, and she found that only 6% of college sexual assault adjudications allow what we would recognize as meaningful cross-examination. That is, that the accused student has a right to a lawyer, and the lawyer can ask questions of the witnesses. So it's as if the goal here really was to design a process to tell sexual assault victims, but also simply sexual assault accusers, we're going to create a system where you can present your story. Your story will not really be challenged at any point in the process in a difficult manner, and you'll be vindicated at the end. And the most favorable or most forgiving explanation for this policy, which has come out, I think, in 2017 from Democratic senators, although they didn't announce it at the time, was a belief that if you make guilty findings far more likely, more sexual assault victims will report the offense to their colleges. There was no interest in having them report to the police. But of course, the problem with that is that we can't have a system where that we find the innocent guilty and their kind of collateral damage in this broader search for societal good. And that's essentially what we've seen on campuses with the Title IX movement.
Casey, it seems to me that there's even a more fundamental problem with the Title IX movement, and that is that colleges and universities are uniquely poorly situated to adjudicate what effectively amount to criminal charges. I mean, assaulting someone sexually is a crime. It's a serious crime. And it seems to me it would be so much better if colleges and universities had a policy of treating with compassion and sensitivity both accusers and accused, and referring the accusers to the authorities and referring the accused to competent defense counsel, and then stepping back from that and letting the criminal justice system, which is designed for this sort of adjudication, to work. Does that seem to you to be far-fetched?
No, I completely agree. There are a couple of points here. The first is that there are some things that that colleges and universities do very well. They have counseling services, they have medical services, and Title IX has required, and I support this, colleges and universities to provide these kind of accommodations to female students who file sexual assault allegations. And colleges and universities are very, very well suited to do this. What they are not well suited to do, as you pointed out, is to undertake what are criminal investigations. And a couple of examples here. The first is there have been around 200 lawsuits filed by accused students against colleges and universities. These are students who say they were wrongly found guilty. And in most instances, based on the material that has come out in the lawsuits, their claim of being wrongfully found guilty were correct. And one of the recurring patterns in these cases is the willingness of colleges and universities to make life-altering decisions affecting their students' lives on the basis of incomplete and oftentimes wildly incomplete evidentiary basis, the sort of thing that colleges wouldn't tolerate in any other thing that, you know, that we do in higher education, because colleges, of course, don't have the subpoena power. So you have a situation where the college can ask an accuser to present relevant evidence, but they can't compel it. And you see case after case after case where there are text messages between the accuser and the accused. Some of these text messages get introduced, others of them do not. In a criminal trial or even in a civil lawsuit, there'd be discovery, there'd be depositions. This material would all come out in the wash before a final decision was made. But in these campus tribunals, colleges can't compel the production of the relevant evidence. So essentially what they're doing is they're making a guess based on whatever evidence happens to come their way through this kind of jerry-rigged process ordered by the federal government, and then hoping that they're right under very strong ideological pressure from campus activists, and at least during the Obama administration, under very strong political pressure from the education department to get more guilty findings. So imagine a scenario where there was a spate of robberies on campus, and the response was, we're going to create campus safety by having these armed robberies tried through campus tribunals. No one in their right mind would say that this was an appropriate response. And yet this is the one crime where we've taken this approach.
Or even murder. I mean, murder is probably the one thing that's more serious than rape.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to establish a hierarchy of horribles, but let's just say that both rape and murder are extremely serious charges. If someone is accused of murder, well, then they go into the criminal justice system, they're arrested, and they get this full panoply of due process protections from the point of notice to the point of, you know, the appellate process, and as you point out, cross-examination, discovery, all these other things that make the process more fair. And yet, this other thing that we pull out of the system, this rape or sexual assault, well, all of a sudden the protections disappear.
Right.
It's extraordinary. And of course, that brings us directly to the issue of the moment, the so-called Me Too movement, which I experienced pretty much just like everybody else did. One day I'm on Facebook and all of a sudden I started seeing the hashtag Me Too. And it's been rather breathtaking as to how much it's taken off and what effect it has. Now, I'm not going to defend anybody who's a sexual assaulter or someone who has raped somebody. I mean, that's indefensible. On the other hand, are we simply supposed to take these things at face value? What about UVA? What about Duke? We know that people make false accusations. We know that people interpret things differently that have happened in the past. Are we simply supposed to take these accusations at face value?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of levels here. The first might be what you could call the Al Franken test. I mean, you know, the now former Minnesota senator. I mean, there are a series of allegations that are made against Franken. Some of them come from anonymous complainers. Others come under what seems to be, complicated cases, where Franken says, well, I didn't do what she said I did, or there was contrasting evidence. And there initially was proposed a procedure through which these allegations would be handled. It was going to go to the Senate Ethics Committee.
Ethics Committee
would investigate, and Franken would have an opportunity to present his defense, and his accusers would have an opportunity. But of course, then it became too politically toxic for the Democrats to keep him around, and there was this strong pressure led ironically by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who has led the Title IX crusade on campuses, basically saying, you know, we believe the women. The Franken case, I think, is a good example of why process matters, because the allegations against Franken may well be true. Indeed, I think you could make a strong argument that they were, but they're murky allegations. This was not Harvey Weinstein. Franken denied them and was never given an opportunity to defend. And then the other point is that if you look at some of the rhetoric behind Me Too, the recurring line is always believe the women.
Yeah.
But what happens when the allegations are false, and more critically, as we know, false allegations exist, and how do we determine what allegations are true and what allegations are false? And the lesson on campus over the last 5 years is that a policy that's simply oriented around believing accusers no matter what because of the serious nature of the offense is one that invites dubious and outright wrongful allegations. And there is, to me, there's absolutely no reason to believe that we're not going to see a similar pattern with regards to Me Too, where, you know, we move on from these kind of clear-cut cases with Weinstein to far more ambiguous cases with Franken, and then doubtless even more ambiguous cases where you have he said, she said allegations from years ago with incomplete evidentiary bases, where the accused party will have almost no chance to defend him or herself. I mean, this morning, there was a congressional candidate in Kansas, a female, who withdrew on the basis of a 10-year-old sexual harassment allegation that she said was made against her by a disgruntled employee. But the National Democrats said, you know, we can't support someone against whom such an allegation has been made. So the allegation becomes the truth. You know, that's the worst aspect of the campus system. And to see it spreading into broader political and national culture is a very, very troubling development.
Well, Casey, we've got a real problem here. We've got the due process, which we've been talking about on one side, and we've got the very serious concerns about sexual assault and misogyny and the domination of women through a hierarchical system which favors men. How do we resolve all this? What's the solution?
We go back to the purpose of due process. And the purpose of due process is not simply to protect the accused, although it does have that effect. The purpose is to provide us a path to the truth, especially when allegations are seriously contested, and especially when allegations involve, you know, deep-seated emotions. And, you know, we don't need to be, you know, sort of detailed knowledge of American history to look at previous instances in U.S. history, whether it was the, you know, the Red Scares after World War I and World War II, whether it was the child daycare cases of the 1980s, that when we allow the emotionalism and the kind of feel-good attitudes of the moment to override fairness for the accused party, ultimately that undoes society. Everyone loses by that kind of system.
Well, Casey Johnson of Brooklyn College of the City University of New York, thank you so very, very much for sharing these very important insights with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to both of our guests, Michelle Goodwin of UC Irvine and to Casey Johnson of Brooklyn College. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.